Welcome to another Salvation by Grace Sunday morning message from Grace Christian Assembly. We are currently engaged in a verse-by-verse exposition of the book of Hebrews. Now, here's our teacher, Jim McLarty.
Good morning to each and every one of you. Oh, and Happy New Year to you. This is the first message of the new year, 2013. It's been eventful so far. I want to start this morning, you can turn to Hebrews 11. I want to start this morning by clarifying something that I said last week. Not because anybody asked, but because I am my own harshest critic. I think everybody in the room understood it when I said it last week, but then listening back to it on the recording, I wasn't content with the way it came across, because in the heat of the moment, in talking about the fact that as a pastor, people like to tell you all the details of their dark past. And so I emphasized that I don't care. And I kept saying, I don't care. The point I was attempting to make is that I don't care how dark your past is. I don't care where you've been. I don't care what you've done. I don't care how deep your sin is. I don't care how much evidence of your depravity you have. Come to Jesus anyway. That was the point of my I don't care speech. And I think I even said, you know what, keep all your junk to yourself. I don't want to hear it. But the point I was making was not that I don't care about you or that I don't care about your life and the trials and the victories of your life. I care about that deeply. I'm in with both feet. If you've got something you want to share with me, by all means, share it with me. Don't say, well, I'm not going to call Jim because, well, he's plainly told us that he doesn't care. That was not my point at all. I do care. I like the phrase, a burden shared is half a burden, and a joy shared is twice the joy. So by all means, come tell me. I want to hear it. Now, last night, I got another one of the middle-of-the-night phone calls. That's why my voice is a little raspy. I'm really tired. I really haven't slept much. But someone called me, one of our listeners out there, who's in trouble. We've devised a plan. When I get home today, we're going to see if we can continue and execute that plan to get this person out of the trouble they're in. And as I laid in bed last night at 2 a.m, staring at the clock going, yeah, still not asleep, I thought, well, that's what I get. This is just God's great ironic sense of humor. This is what I get for saying out loud, I don't care. Is that God decided to find out if I cared. And it turns out, I do. The preacher job, I had someone comment to me just a couple of weeks ago, boy, you have a great job. You preach twice a week, and that's what you do for a living. And sure, there might be some time involved in preparation, but they really think that this is all I do. When I used to be on the road as a musician, we would travel all over the place in buses and hotels and airplanes, just wear you out. Very hard being on the road. But we would do it for that hour each night that we were on stage, or whatever the time period was for that particular night in that particular place. But you would do all the traveling, you'd put up with all that for the moment when you get to be on stage. So I used to tell folks, we play for free. They pay us to travel, because that was the hard part of the job. Well, the preaching part of my job now is a small part of the overall job, but it's the part that I would do for free and did for many, many years. I preached for free for years, would not take money to preach. I understand it when Paul said, woe to me if I preach not the gospel, writing to the Corinthians. He said, if I do this thing willingly, I have my reward. If unwillingly, nevertheless, a dispensation of the gospel has been given to me. And so he was under compulsion to preach. He didn't have a choice but preach. And I feel the same way. That's why I preached for free for years and years and years, because I didn't have an option about teaching and preaching. I was going to do it no matter what, because I'm a soldier and I'm on marching orders from my king. And I understand that. I get it now. I've quit rebelling against that. I've quit bucking at that. This is what I'm called to do, and so I do it. And if someone had said, you know what? We're willing to pay you a living wage to preach twice a week, I would jump in and say, yes, where do I sign up? Because that means I get to do the best part of the job and make a living at it. But if anybody ever wrote an honest job description of the ministry, if you're really doing the ministry and you're committed to it and you're trying to do it well, if anybody wrote that job description and then said, here's the job and here's the pay, nobody's going to sign up for this. People are going to go, no, thank you, I'll pass. I think I'd rather be a carpenter or something, or plumber. There are other job options. I don't have to do this. I was talking to Elder Spots down in Chattanooga a few months ago, because preachers need preachers. Preachers need preachers to talk to, because we have to unload on somebody. And especially if it's a preacher in a different town who doesn't know the people you're talking about, that's really helpful, because then you can just kind of unload. And we were in the midst of one of those sharing and unloading sessions on the phone. And he said, you know, Elder Ward used to say that pastors are like dumpsters, because everybody brings their garbage and they dump it into the pastor. And he said, and if you don't have some place to unload it, you'll just explode. And that's true. You carry around all this stuff and you end up keeping so many secrets, and you look at people and you think, oh, I know you, I know your background, I know your pain, I know what you're going through, I know your difficulties. And then, you know, we're on the internet, and so then I get the extra email and the phone calls in the middle of the night stuff from all these different areas. So my point in saying all that is, the job for which I get paid is sometimes not worth what I get paid. Some of what I know isn't worth the money. And so it's a good thing that I am under compulsion. It's a good thing that the king has a firm hand on me. And it's a good thing that his word continues to encourage and comfort me and drive this ministry forward. I say all that to say, pray for your pastor. And I'm saying this to the internet too. Whoever your pastor is, wherever your pastor is, pray for your pastor. Because sometimes the gig is really difficult. Yes, ma'am.
Specifically, how do you want us to pray for you? For strength?
Early death.
I thought you wanted to skip the dead part.
I do want to skip the dead part, but sometimes it looks attractive. I'm going to answer your question, because it's a really good question. Pray for perseverance, because as a human, I'm really much too egocentric to do what I'm called to do. I say all the time that Christianity, real Christianity, done right, is about giving yourself away. Philippians 2, let every man look on the things of others and not on his own things. Esteem others as better than yourself. Anybody doing that? Anybody got that down? Anyone? No? Nothing? Yeah, but that's the call of genuine Christianity, is to give yourself away on behalf of other people. The love that Christians are called to is not phileo. It's not friend to friend, side by side, I scratch your back, you scratch mine kind of love. It's not conditional love. We're called to agapao, agape love, which is sacrificial love that is doing for the one that is loved what is in the best benefit for the one being loved, even if the one being loved doesn't want it, doesn't know it, doesn't care, and if you get no reward back. It's sacrificial love, which is why Jesus would say things like, there's no greater love than this, but that a man would lay down his life for his friends. Okay, well, that's a physical reality where Christ was concerned. He did lay down his life for his friends. But it's also what we're called to do on a daily basis. Lay down our lives on behalf of our friends and our brethren and the saints and that kind of thing. And so that's a really, really big call. And so if you'll pray for me that I'll do that better, I'll pray for you that you do it better. And we'll all collectively continue this Christian journey. And someday, Jesus is going to crack the sky and come get us. That'll be a good day. And in between, we're called to be a demonstration, salt and light in this world. And by this will all men know that you are my brethren by your love one for another, that you are my disciples by your love one for another. So pray for endurance. Pray that God will keep his hand on me, and I'll pray that God keeps his hand on you. Fair enough? All right, good. Hebrews 11. Last week, we got an introductory overview of the chapter. I pointed out that there is a promise afoot, and the promise was not received by the forefathers, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. We're going to get into them this morning. They did not receive the promise. And then the writer of Hebrews continued on and talks about the various heroes of faith from the Old Testament. He's going to take them in chronological order, and then he's just going to start talking in large groupings. As he talks about these groupings, he's finally going to say that all these, collectively, the Old Testament, all of the saints listed in the Old Testament, all the stories from the Old Testament, all of them collectively, Israel, all the way up to the point of Jesus, he said, have not received the promise. And so we have to keep that in mind as we're going through Hebrews 11, and keep in mind that as he introduces the promise, the land promise, the Abrahamic promise, his conclusion is going to be that nobody in the Old Testament received it. And as we saw last week, he's going to say, because God had something better planned so that they without us would not be made complete. In other words, he cast the fulfillment of the promise out into the future and said that when the promise is fulfilled, it's going to be collective. That's a great, great promise for Israel. That's a great, great promise for the 12 tribes who have the promise. But as we look at the way that the promise worked its way down through the generations of the forefathers, I'm going to prove to you that the birthright promise, which includes the land promise, belongs to the northern 10 tribes. It belongs specifically to Ephraim. Ephraim became the chief tribes of the northern 10. As a consequence, the northern 10 tribes become known by the nickname of Ephraim and are sometimes called collectively Mount Ephraim. They're also called Israel collectively, as the southern tribes are called Judah collectively. And so I'm going to show you that that promise, the land promise, and the fulfillment of that promise belongs to the northern tribes. The reason that's so very important is that the writer of Hebrews, writing to Hebrews, is writing to a largely Jewish, Jerusalem-based, believing audience. And so when he says, none of them received the promise, and the people he's writing to know that they also have not received the promise. He says it's because God has a better plan in mind so that we collectively will receive the promise. If that sounds familiar, it's perfectly in league with what all of the Old Testament prophets say, that God is going to gather all 12 tribes collectively again. All Israel will be saved. By all Israel, he means all 12 tribes collectively. And that is going to happen at some point, but it hasn't happened yet. So what are you going to do about that? You either say, well, God's not going to do it, changed his mind. Or you say, well, he is accomplishing it, but in some sort of spiritualized fashion, which is a conclusion that no Bible writer comes to. Despite the fact that that is a very popular theology, no Bible writer says that. So when someone says that, you have to recognize that they're making that up extra biblically. If they push that into the text, then they're working eisegetically. They're taking conclusions that are outside the text and pushing them into the text. But if we just take the text at face value, what we have to conclude is God made these promises to Israel. A Hebrew writing to Hebrews after the cross says God has not fulfilled his promise yet, so that we collectively will all receive it. That means that he still expects it in its completion, in its totality, and he expects it in the future. So, that's what I believe. I believe it's going to happen, and it's going to happen sometime in the future, and God's going to do it. And when you get to the book of Revelation, and you end up in Revelation 20, and you start reading about a 1,000-year kingdom, that would be the perfect place to fulfill it, seems to me. So keeping all that in mind, when we get to Abraham being a sojourner, a pilgrim, in the land he was promised, which is referred to by the writer of Hebrews as the land of promise, that even though he and his children, Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, dwell in tents and have no permanent home, they believe and are looking forward to and embrace off in the distance, says the writer of Hebrews. They still embrace the promise. They see it afar off. They know that God is going to do it, and they still, by faith, are looking forward to it. So when we say, well, God said it, he hasn't done it yet, but he's going to do it, that faith is still looking forward to God fulfilling his word, doing everything he said he's going to do, and that faith is counted as righteousness. Well, this is a very good deal, because Karen ain't righteous. Sorry, I just looked over and saw you. Would you like to debate it? No. Okay, so how is Karen ever going to have righteousness in front of a righteous, holy, supremely holy God who is willing to judge unrighteousness? Well, there's only one way. He has to give her righteousness. He has to give it to her, impute it to her as a gift, and he will do that in exchange for faith. He gives her the faith. We're going to see that at the beginning of chapter 12. Jesus Christ, the author and finisher of faith. So he gives her the faith, and that faith demonstrates itself in the way she embraces the word of God and the promises that are in the word of God. When she sees the promises in the Word and she stands on those promises, that is the demonstration that the Holy Spirit of God is in her and that she has faith in the Word, and God is going to give her righteousness in exchange for that. Oh, good. That's just good news.
Yes, it is.
So we're in Hebrews. We're in Hebrews 11. Now, faith is the assurance of things hoped for, the conviction of things not seen. In my introductory comments, I didn't mention this, but I'm going to tell you now. When I was out in California, there was a movement in the early fledgling Word of Faith movement, if you don't mind the redundancy of that. But there was a portion of the Word of Faith movement, they were called the Now Faith people. And basically what they said, you know this, you're familiar with them. And they used to say, it's not good enough to rest on yesterday's faith, and you don't yet have tomorrow's faith. The only faith that matters is the faith you have now. You have to have now faith. You know what their text was? Hebrews 11:1, now faith is the assurance. I'm telling you the truth. Kenneth Copeland was way into that. Yes. That was their proof text. Now faith. Exactly. So get the t-shirts, print up the bumper stickers, and get going. Hashtag now faith. And now faith is the substance of things hoped for. Exactly. You got to have the now faith. Yes, Jeff?
No, I'm saying that that same group, the group abuses that word substance and requires it as an actual substance. And so faith is a substance. And words are the containers of the substance. So when you speak forth faith-filled words, you're creating reality like God does. Mm-hmm. It's a total butchering the text.
Yeah. So I just wanted to point that out to show you what people will do to a text. So faith is the assurance of things hoped for. It is the conviction of things not seen. For by it the men of old, the forefathers, gained approval or had a good report. By faith, we understand that the worlds were prepared by the word of God, so that what is seen was not made out of things which are visible. By faith, Abel offered to God a better sacrifice than Cain, through which he obtained the testimony that he was righteous. God testifying about his gifts, and through faith, though he is dead, he still speaks. That's how far we got last week. Verse 5 says, by faith, Enoch was taken up so that he would not see death. And then he quotes straight from Genesis, and he was not found because God took him. For he obtained the witness that before his being taken up, he was pleasing to God. And then verse 6 is a continuation of the same thought. Very frequently, people will pull verse 6 from its context, but he says, and without faith, the and there, the conjunction, the and, is because he's using this now as the basis, the logic for what he just said. We don't know a lot about Enoch. What we know about Enoch from the book of Genesis is that he's the seventh from Adam. That's what we know. In fact, let's go back and look at it. Keep your finger there in Hebrews. Go back to Genesis 5. Genesis 5, we'll start at like verse 18. Not like verse 18, we're going to start at verse 18, actual 18. Jared lived 162 years, and he became the father of Enoch. Then Jared lived 800 years after he became the father of Enoch, and he had other sons and daughters. So all the days of Jared were 962 years, and he died. Now, even though 962 seems like a lot of years, he wasn't the oldest. His grandson is going to live longer than him. Then here's what we know about Enoch. Verse 21, and Enoch lived 65 years and became the father of Methuselah. Then Enoch walked with God 300 years after he became the father of Methuselah, which gives you some indication that in the first portion of his life, he didn't walk with God, and then he had Methuselah, apparently had some sort of revelation of something based on the fact that he named his son what he named him. Hebrew names are very interesting. I like to look up Hebrew names. The name Methuselah means, it's actually a contraction of two words. The first word means death, and the second word is when it comes. And so the name Methuselah means when he dies, it happens. And after having a child named Methuselah, Enoch starts walking and talking with God. Enoch also is quoted in the book of Jude. And it's a really interesting quote because Jude says that according to Enoch, that Christ is coming back with the 10,000s of his saints, which means that Enoch is the first recorded prophet in the Bible, and the first prophecy by a prophet in the Bible is a prophecy about the return of Christ. Isn't that fascinating? Enoch has a kid, names him Methuselah, names him, when he dies, it comes. When he dies, it happens. And that man, if you want to see a demonstration of God's grace in the Old Testament, that man lives longer than any man ever lived. Because when he dies, it happens. Now, by the way, if you know that there's a guy on the planet whose name is, when he dies, it comes, it happens, you're going to check on this guy all the time, aren't you? You'd be like in his room every day, how you feeling? Methuselah, you good? Okay, can I get you anything? Let me show you how accurate it really was. I did the math. When Methuselah died, the flood came. Methuselah was 187 when he had Lamech, and he lived 782 years more after that. Lamech had Noah when he was 182, and the flood came in Noah's 600th year. So if you take 187 and you add 182 and you add 600, you get 969, and we're about to read that Methuselah died when he was 969. Which means that God predicted when the flood would come 969 years in advance and was exactly right. That's that sovereign God we're talking about. And took the time, by the way, to record it. Write it down. Noah is 120 years building an ark in a desert. And as we're about to read, the writer of Hebrews says that he was told something that nobody had ever seen before, nobody ever knew. So when God said, not only I'm going to flood the earth, but he said, I'm going to flood the earth with rain. When you read the Genesis account, it says that there was a mist that came up out of the ground that watered the garden, which has led to what is commonly called the canopy theory, which basically is the idea that perhaps up until Noah, that the world was covered with a sort of canopy so that there was just a humid mist that kept the ground green and watered, but that there had never been rain. God shows up and says to Noah, it's going to rain. Noah has no idea really what that means. But then God adds, it's going to rain for so long, I'm going to flood the earth. Noah still doesn't really know what that means. God adds, I'm going to kill everybody. Noah goes, I'll build a boat. 120 years building a boat while checking on Methuselah. Methuselah dies, the rain comes, Noah's in the boat. That's really, really interesting because there are also folk who are premillennial, pre-tribulational, what I call pre-everythingists. And when they're looking for evidences of a pre-tribulation rapture or taking away of the church, they go back to Genesis and they say, look, the judgment is clearly the flood. But before the flood, there's a rapture. Enoch walked and talked with God and was not because God took him. And the very next thing you read about is the judgment on the world. So there are also folk who say, if you just look at that typologically, it fits that particular eschatological bent. I've never personally tried to make that argument because I don't really need it, but I am a pre-everythingist. Verse 22, chapter 5 of the book of Genesis says, then Enoch walked with God 300 years after he became the father of Methuselah, and he had other sons and daughters, so all the days of Enoch were 365. Isn't that an interesting number? Since God's being really accurate with numbers here, interesting that it's 365. Just thought I'd point it out. And Enoch walked with God, and he was not, because God took him. I want more explanation than that. Except that that's all we read about. That's all we know about Enoch. He had Methuselah. He walked and talked with God, was not anymore, God took him. Based on that, the writer of Hebrews says, now the reason God took him was because he had walked and talked with God, which means he had faith. So let's go back to Hebrews. Hebrews 11:5, by faith Enoch was taken up so that he should not see death. So he tells us very clearly, he was raptured, he was plucked off the planet. I got into a little debate with a preacher one time, years ago, who, he started with the challenge. He said, you believe in the rapture, don't you? And I said, well, yeah. He said, you can't find the word rapture anywhere in the Bible. Right, but you can find the word harpazo, which is a word that means to take something by force. It was a word that was used for like when robbers or criminals would fall on people who were traveling on the road. When they would take their stuff, they would take it by force. It's that word, and it's that exact word that Paul uses in the Thessalonian letter to say that Christ is going to come and harpazo his people, pluck them up off the planet, and they're going to rise up to meet the Lord in the air. Paul even says, now comfort one another with these words. So it's a comfort to the church to know that Jesus is going to come and get his people. So I said, okay, fine. Rapture's not in the Bible. Harpazo is. Trinity's not in the Bible. But the concept is. Hold on. The word Bible's not in the Bible. But we get it. So, okay, the rapture, the word isn't in there. And he said, you can't find a rapture anywhere in the Bible. And I choked and then said, Enoch? He thought that I was going to be over there arguing in the Thessalonian letter. He was all set to argue Paul with me. I said, Enoch? And he just stared at me for like 2 minutes and went, well, okay, you can find that one. Yes, because it's right there. And Elijah, absolutely. There are clearly Old Testament demonstrations of it, right? It's just not that hard to discover. So here's what the writer of Hebrews says about it. It says, Enoch was taken up so that he would not see death. Clearly, a rapture, a harpazo, a stealing away of a human who's walking and talking and doing his thing and one day wasn't because God took him. I like that idea, by the way. And he was not found because God took him up is a quote from Genesis from what we just read. For he obtained the witness that before being taken up, he was pleasing to God. That's what we read in Genesis. He walked and talked with God. Okay, he was pleasing to God. And he's continuing the thought, verse 6, and without faith, it is impossible to please him. So he had this testimony that he pleased God, and without faith, it's impossible to please God. So he's telling you logically why he has concluded that this happened as a result of faith. He's saying it's axiomatic. Without faith, you can't please God, and we're told that Enoch pleased God. So Enoch must have had faith. That's the argument. Without faith, it is impossible to please him. For he who comes to God must believe two things. They that come to God must believe that he is. That's really interesting. Because it starts with the assumption that the atheist, part of the reason he has never come to God, is that he doesn't believe God is. Doesn't believe God exists. Now, if it's true, everything we read in the Bible about God revealing himself to particular people, then the reason that some people don't believe he is because God has never introduced himself to them. Moses didn't know God. 40 years on the backside of nowhere after 40 years of living as a prince in Egypt, he had had no experience with God whatsoever and would have continued in that ignorant state had God not spoken to him. He's out there tending to his father-in-law's sheep, sees a bush burning but not being consumed, walks over to see it, as anyone would, and a voice says, Moses, which I find amazing, because God knew exactly who he was and where he was and had a plan for him, didn't say, hey, shepherd guy, you with the sheep, beardo, come here. It was, you liked that one, did you? Did you like beardo? Don't try it on me. By the way, also don't try bald or any version of that, or I'll tell you the Elisha story. So God spoke to Moses and revealed himself to Moses. My point being, anywhere in the Bible that you find anybody who knows anything about God, it's because God revealed himself to them, which means if you know anything about God, it's because God revealed himself to you, which is a tremendous gift. Only then are you going to approach God or come to God because you know that he is. But not only do you have to know that he is, which, by the way, I also have to add this. God defines himself as the God that is. When he spoke to Moses and said, go tell Pharaoh, let my people go. He said, well, who am I going to tell Pharaoh? Who should I say sent me? That was a terrible sentence. When I do that, and I speak to Pharaoh, who should I say sent me? Because remember, he's been raised in Egypt for 40 years. He knows the pantheon of Egyptian gods. They have gods for everything. And now this God speaks to him, so he says, okay, I'll go tell Pharaoh, but which God are you? Who should I say sent me? And he says, I am. You go tell Pharaoh, I am sent you. And then he explains himself as, I am that I am. In other words, I am self-existent. The big philosophical idea is God is the only entity in the universe, the only personality in the universe, whose reason for existence resides completely within himself. You get that? He is because he is. And he doesn't explain himself beyond that. I am. Which also, by the way, indicates that all those Egyptian gods are not. Simply ain't. I am the God that is. They are the gods that are not. You go tell Pharaoh, the God that is said, let my people go. And I am the only one that is. I am because I am. Everything else that is because he first was. Everything else that is because he decided it would be. But only he is because he is. So he is the only self-existent one. So you have to believe that. You have to believe that he is before you'll ever come to him. And you have to believe that he is a rewarder of those. Now the NASB says those that seek him. King James says those that diligently seek him. The reason that they added the word diligently is because the word seek there is a present tense participle. In other words, I've described this many times to you as it's an action that is now and now and now. And now. Don't you now faith me. We'll just take this whole thing in a weird direction. It's a constancy of believing. It's a constancy of having confidence that God rewards those who seek him, and it's a seeking that is constant. It's an ongoing seeking. It's never reaching the point where you say, well, I've got that whole God thing covered. I got that down. So here's the two things that it takes to please God. You have to believe that he is, and you believe that he's a rewarder of those who are always looking for him, always seeking him. Now that's just logical, that's just rational, because if you didn't believe he was, you wouldn't seek him. If you didn't believe that he would reward your seeking, if you were convinced that he was trying to keep you away, and that if you ever came looking for him, he would say no and resist you. No, instead, you believe that he is and that he is a rewarder of those who are in the constant now state of looking for him, seeking him, recognizing him, knowing he's part of your life, having that constant awareness of the reality of God. By the way, this is a really good thing to practice. Practice the reality of the presence of God. And all I mean by that is awareness. I'm not talking about any kind of mystical, I found God. When you're in the middle of your workday and it's hard and things are going tough and you feel buried and there's a lot of deadlines and you go, man, this is just really, just pause for a moment and go, but God is here. He's right here right now. God's here. He knows what he's doing. He has me here right now for a purpose. I'm going to get through this. Very, very helpful when you're in trouble or when you're sick. That's why Paul would write, there's no temptation taking you, no trial taking you, but such as is common to man. But God is faithful, who will, with the temptation, provide a way of escape so that you may be able to bear it. He writes that because he recognizes that if you just remember, God is here and he's designed this and I'm going through it on purpose and it's the kind of stuff humans go through, and God has provided a way of escape, well, then you're going to bear it. You're going to get through it. So he is, and he is a rewarder of those who are in a regular, constant, continual state of recognition, of seeking him, of calling to him, praying to him, looking for him, recognizing that he exists and he's with you. And that'll get you through some tough times, by the way. God is here. I know I've already vented about this a little bit to begin with this morning, but I'm not just talking theoretically right now. Last night, in the midst of the upheaval, it was the knowledge that God is here that took me through it. Because had I been doing that under my own strength, I would have, well, let's just say I would have done it differently had I done it at all. But it was the knowledge that God is here, he's present, he's real, he's active. He has not brought this into my life randomly. This is happening on purpose. These things are happening because there's a plan working out, and God knows what that plan is. And that plan is going to result in his glory and my good. And even in the midst of what looked like a terrible situation, the remembrance, the constancy of God is here will get you through it. So I'm not just talking theory here. I'm talking life. You understand? All right. Without faith, it's impossible to please God, for he who comes to God must believe that he is and that he is a rewarder of those who diligently seek him. By faith, Noah, I just mentioned, Noah being warned by God about things not yet seen. I find that a fascinating phrase. That means that the writer of Hebrews understood some things about Genesis and about the pre-flood world in Genesis, where there was something about the rain, the flood, the event that had never been seen, hadn't been conceived of, and yet God said to Noah, I'm going to bring rain, I'm going to flood the earth, I'm going to kill everybody, you're going to make a boat. You and your family, eight people alone, are going to be on that boat, and oh yeah, two of every animal, get busy. Seven of all the animals that can be used for sacrifice. You know that, right? It's not just two animals. Any animal that was a clean animal that could be used for sacrifice, seven of those. Now, how is Noah supposed to, number one, build a boat big enough for all these animals? And he's supposed to collect those animals. There's a big job. So the writer of Hebrews says, Noah did this by faith. Well, yeah, you can see faith demonstrated here. He believed what God said to him, despite the fact that he couldn't begin to imagine it. I can't imagine it now. I know the story. But can you imagine a flood so cataclysmic that everybody on the planet and all the animals, everything, dies? Can you even fathom that? It makes a nice Sunday school story. The animals in a boat floating on the water. That's a nice Sunday school story. They never tell you the part about, and millions of corpses floating in the water underneath the boat. They never mention that part. They kind of edited that part out, sure. But that's the real story. Noah is told, by faith Noah, being warned by God about things he had not yet seen, in reverence, prepared an ark for the salvation of his household, by which, this phrase is amazing, by which he condemned the world. In other words, as Noah was building the boat, as Noah was a demonstration of faith in what God said. Remember the definition of faith that I keep offering you, that faith is standing on God's word and accounting it as more true than your circumstances? You got to know that about 60, 70, 80 years into the boat building enterprise, Noah was getting a lot of heat from his neighbors. You got to know that they were coming out there regularly saying, so where's this thing again? I mean, you've been telling us this for 80 years. I don't see any water. But he's still got to go out every day and work. Still got to go build that boat every day. By the preparing of the ark for the salvation of his household, he condemned the world. The very simple fact that he had faith in God was a demonstration of the reality of God at work on the planet. He was only at work in one man and that man's family. Who, by the way, let me also point out that after the flood, Noah's going to plant a vineyard and get sloshed. So it's not like he's the good one. Instead, what you read is Noah found grace in the eyes of the Lord. Okay, well, good, because it's always going to be about grace whenever God saves anybody, and God is going to give the gift of faith, and he's arguing here that Noah had faith, and he didn't just have faith, he had the kind of faith where he built a boat because he believed what God said. He believed God's word more than he believed his circumstances. And the writer of Hebrews says, and by it, he condemned the world. Because he had faith in what God said, they rejected what God said, and they all fell under God's punishment and judgment. and he became the heir of the righteousness which is according to faith. So what did he get out of it? The result of the faith is righteousness. So that he became heir of the righteousness that is according to faith. By faith, Abraham. Now, when we were doing our study of the book of Genesis, I pointed out that the early part of the book of Genesis moves really fast. It just moves at a heavy-duty clip, and you just read these little brief synopses of different people and what they did, and they're just there for a moment, and they're gone from the story. Things like we just saw with Enoch. Enoch was born, he walked and talked with God, he had Methuselah, he was not. That's as much as we know about Enoch. Short little clips. So the book of Genesis is very good at giving us these short little clips, but once it gets to Abraham, once you see Abram introduced to the story, the book of Genesis finally just opens up. And you start reading the story of God's interaction with the forefathers, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, and the promises that are made. And those promises reverberate all the way into the New Testament. So I'm going to show you that, and we're going to call it a morning. Go to the book of Genesis again, because we have to talk about this. We have to talk about, by faith, Abraham, when he was called, obeyed by going out to a place which he was to receive for an inheritance, and he went out not knowing where he was going. By faith, he lived as an alien in the land of promise, as in a foreign land. That's what we're going to look at. Let's start in Genesis. It's going to be around 12 is a good place to start. Genesis 12, right at the top. I'm going to show you seven recitations of the Abrahamic covenant. And I'm going to show you that the Abrahamic covenant is passed down as an inheritance from Abraham to Isaac to Jacob. If it were a birthright blessing, a standard birthright blessing, it would go to the oldest. In which case, it would have gone to Ishmael. But it doesn't. God is very specific and says, "In Isaac shall thy seed be called." So he says, chapter 12, verse 1 of the book of Genesis, "Now the Lord said to Abram, go forth from your country and from your relatives and from your father's house to a land that I will show you. I will make you a great nation, and I will bless you, and I will make your name great. And so you shall be a blessing. And I will bless those who bless you, and I will curse those who curse you. And in you all the families of the earth shall be blessed." So Abram went forth as the Lord had spoken to him, and Lot went with him. That's exactly what the writer of Hebrews was referring to, that God came to him and said, leave your father, leave your country, leave your people, and start walking. And you're going to get to a land, and I'll let you know when you get there. And by faith, according to the writer of Hebrews, he did it. He sojourned out, took his family. That had to have been an interesting conversation. Honey, we're leaving. Where are we going? No idea. Why are we doing this? God said so. And somehow Sarah goes, yeah, all right. Get Lot, we're moving. Gets all his servants, his household, everything, takes off. Go to chapter 15. The problem that Abram has is that he has no child. He assumes that Eliezer, who is the head of his household, is going to be his sole heir. He's getting old, his wife is too old to have kids, and yet God has just said to him, I'm going to make a great nation out of you. You're going to be so plentiful that you're going to be a great nation of people. God even changes his name from Abram, exalted father, to Abraham, a father of multitudes. He has no kids. And so chapter 15 says, after these things, the word of the Lord came to Abram in a vision saying, do not fear, Abram. I am a shield to you. Your reward shall be very great. And Abram said, O Lord God, what will you give me since I am childless, and the heir of my household is Eliezer of Damascus? And Abram said, since thou have given me no offspring, then one born in my house is going to be my heir, speaking of Eliezer. Then behold, the word of the Lord came to him, saying, this man will not be your heir, but one who shall come forth from your own body, he will be your heir. And he took him outside and he said, now look toward the heavens, count the stars. If you're able to count them, that's how many descendants you're going to have. Verse 6, is a verse that is picked up repeatedly in the New Testament. Abram believed God. I told you last week it's Amon. He amened God, and God reckoned that to him for righteousness. Paul picks that up in the New Testament and says that has always been the way that righteousness has come about. It is always believing whatever God has said. So Abram was told, you're going to have children. Abram believed it. God counted that to him for righteousness. Go to chapter 17, verse 1, the third telling of the covenant. Now when Abram was 99 years old, the Lord appeared to Abram and said to him, I am God Almighty. Walk before me, be blameless, and I will establish my covenant between me and you. I will multiply you exceedingly. And Abram fell on his face, and God talked to him, saying, as for me, behold, my covenant is with you, and you shall be the father of a multitude of nations. No longer shall your name be called Abram, but your name shall be Abraham, for I will make you the father of a multitude of nations, and I will make you exceedingly fruitful, and I will make nations of you, and kings shall come forth from you, and I will establish my covenant between me and you and your descendants after you throughout your generations for an everlasting covenant to be a God to you and to your descendants after you. And I will give to you and your descendants after you the land of your sojourning, all the land of Canaan, for an everlasting possession, and I will be their God. God said further to Abraham, now as for you, you shall keep my covenant, you and your descendants after you, throughout your generations. This is my covenant which you shall keep between me and you and your descendants after you. Every male among you shall be circumcised, and you shall be circumcised in the flesh of your foreskin, and it shall be a sign of a covenant between me and you. Go down to verse 18. Abraham said, O God, that Ishmael may live before me. He'd already had Ishmael. You know the story. He went in a tent with Hagar. He tried to work out in his flesh what God had promised him by faith. He's still waiting to have this child of promise. He finally goes to God and says, look, let it be Ishmael. Okay, let's just do that. God says, verse 19, no, but Sarah, your wife, will bear you a son. And you will call his name Isaac, which means laughter. And I will establish my covenant with him for an everlasting covenant for his descendants after him. Then he says, as for Ishmael, I heard you. I'm going to bless him. He's going to have 12 princes. Don't worry about him. But the seed, the promise, the covenant is going to go through Isaac. Still got that? Keep going forward. Next chapter, chapter 18, verse 17. The Lord said, fascinating phrase, the Lord said, shall I hide from Abraham what I'm about to do? That's interesting. Since Abraham will surely become a great and a mighty nation, and in him all the nations of the earth are going to be blessed. For I have chosen him in order that he may command his children and his household after him to keep the way of the Lord by doing righteousness and justice, in order that the Lord may bring upon Abraham what he has spoken about him. And then the Lord talks about Sodom and Gomorrah, and he's going to destroy Sodom and Gomorrah. Go forward. God keeps repeating the promise over and over again. Chapter 22. This is after God has said, take your child, your only child, Isaac's been born. Take him up on a hill, kill him. Sacrifice him to me. He goes up there and does everything God says to do. He raises the knife, an angel stops him, and at that exact moment, there just happens to be a ram caught in a thicket. A substitutionary ram with his head in thorns. Should we spell it out? He becomes the substitutionary sacrifice for Isaac. Verse 14, and Abram called the name of the place, the Lord will provide, as it is to this day. In the mount of the Lord it will be provided. The angel of the Lord called to Abraham a second time from heaven and said, by myself I have sworn, declares the Lord, because you have done this thing and have not withheld your son, your only son, indeed I will greatly bless you, and I will multiply your seed as the stars of the heavens and as the sand which is on the seashore, and your seed shall possess the gates of their enemies. And in your seed all the nations of the earth shall be blessed because you obeyed my voice. So Abraham returned with the young men, and they arose and they went together to Beersheba. One last recitation. Keep going forward. Isaac. Isaac, of course, has children. Jacob is one. Twins in a womb, Jacob and Esau. While the twins are still in the womb, before they've done any good or evil, God says, Jacob I've loved, Esau I've hated. Esau is the firstborn. Jacob gets the blessing. I'm in chapter 28, verse 11. Jacob's having a dream. He came to a certain place and he spent the night there because the sun had set. And he took one of the stones of the place and he put it under his head and he laid down in that place and he had a dream. And behold, a ladder was set on the earth and at its top it reached to heaven. And behold, the angels of God were ascending and descending on it. And behold, the Lord stood above it and said, I am the Lord, the God of your father Abraham and the God of Isaac. The land on which you lay, I will give it to you and your descendants. Your descendants shall also be like the dust of the earth, and you shall spread out to the west and to the east and to the north and to the south. And in you and in your descendants shall all the families of the earth be blessed. And behold, I am with you, and I will keep you wherever you go, and I will bring you back to this land, for I will not leave you until I have done what I have promised you. Okay, all I'm seeking to show you there is that God gave a promise to Abraham, to Isaac, to Jacob. It was passed down to each of them. As he was dying, Jacob, who has had his name changed to Israel, who has gone into Egypt because Joseph, the son that he loved the most, the one that he gave the colorful coat, the one that he believed was dead, Joseph has now become second only to Pharaoh in Egypt. His brothers appear before him, and he says, bring Dad. That's the really Cliff Notes version of the story. It's a wonderful story. His father gets there, and while his dad's in Egypt, one thing his father says is, make sure when this is over, you take my bones back, because I have a promise to be in that land. Take me to that land. Joseph, when he dies, leaves a command, make sure my bones go back to Canaan, because that's my land, that's my inheritance, that's where I want to go. Before he dies, Israel leans on his staff, tells Joseph, bring me your sons. He brings in his sons, Manasseh and Ephraim. Joseph dutifully puts the elder son, Manasseh, at his father's right hand so that his father will give the birthright blessing to the oldest son. The old blind man reaches out his hands crisscrossed and puts his right hand on Ephraim's head. And Joseph says, not so, father, not so. And his father rebukes him and says, I know what I'm doing. And he gives the birthright blessing that we just read, the inheritance of the land, to Ephraim. And it belongs there to this very day. Quickly look up somebody. 1 Chronicles 5, 1 and 2. Oh man, we got to move. 1 Chronicles 5, 1 and 2. Everybody else go to Galatians 3, 15. In the New Testament. I'm going to Galatians 3, 15 with the rest of you. Tom, are you heading for Chronicles? Somebody going there? 1 Chronicles 5, 1 and 2 is going to say exactly what I just said. Remember what the book of Chronicles is. The book of Chronicles is a chronicle. Very good. I'm glad you were with me on that. It's a listing of the descendants and the people of Israel, and a chronicle of the kings, and a chronicle of the seed. As you read through the Old Testament, remember that there's a promise given to the seed of Abraham, and it is chronicled and listed all the way through the Old Testament, which is why when you open the New Testament, you open to the book of Matthew, and what do you see right away? A genealogy. The genealogy traces the seed of Jesus back to David, and when Luke does it, takes him all the way back to Adam. Proves the genealogy. The genealogy was very, very important. Then Paul later will say, forget about the endless genealogies, which is really interesting, because that's Paul saying it's done what it was supposed to do. It showed you who the Christ is. He's been here now, so we can forget the genealogy thing. Okay, so now we're into the Chronicles, and he is explaining the divisions and responsibilities among the tribes of Israel, and we read this. Read the first two verses, please.
The sons of Reuben, the firstborn of Israel, he was the firstborn, but when he defiled his father's marriage bed, his rights as firstborn were given to the sons of Joseph, son of Israel, so he could not...
Okay, now hold on. Do you understand what he just said? Reuben was the firstborn, should have gotten the birthright, but he defiled his father's bed. And so the birthright blessing went to Joseph's children. And you go back and you read it, you know that it went to Ephraim. This is standard Hebrew. They know this stuff. We don't know it because we're 20th century Gentiles. We read the New Testament and treat the Bible like it's a promise box. So we don't know the history. But every Hebrew, every Jew knows this, that the land promise belongs to Ephraim. But he then says, but the rulership belongs to Judah, because as he was dying, leaning on his staff, old blind Israel said, but lawgiving will not depart. The scepter, the rulership, will not depart from Judah. So for the first time, you see the Abrahamic covenant that includes, through you, all the nations of the earth are going to be blessed. That's going to Judah, and that's going to the Christ. But then there's the land promise. This land is yours in perpetuity forever. It belongs to Ephraim. Read again. Start at the top.
Okay. The sons of Reuben, the firstborn of Israel, he was the firstborn, but when he defiled his father's marriage bed, his rights as firstborn were given to the sons of Joseph, son of Israel. So he could not be listed in the genealogical record in accordance with his birthright. And through Judah was the strongest of his brothers, and a ruler came from him, and rights of the firstborn belonged to Joseph.
So through Judah comes the lawgiver, comes Christ, comes the Messiah, but the rights of the firstborn belong to Ephraim. It's as clear as it can be. It's just people have forgotten this. Now, everybody turn to Galatians 3, and we're done. What are we going to say about that? Has that changed? Jesus came, Jesus left. Moses came, the law was instituted. Jesus came and did away with the law, nailed it to his tree, taking it out of the way. So what about this Abrahamic promise? What about the Abrahamic covenant? What about through your seed all the nations of the earth are going to be blessed? We can say, well, okay, that was through Christ, and now all the nations of the earth are receiving the blessing of Christ. So, okay, that's fulfilled. Okay, but what about that land promise thing? Well, first off, it belongs to Ephraim. And until Ephraim gets it, it's not fulfilled. Secondly, is the promise still good? Or once Jesus came, did God go, okay, well, close enough. We'll spiritualize it. You know. There are two elements to it, and it belongs to two different groups. It belongs to Judah, and it belongs to Ephraim. And you get that. Do you know how hard it is to get people to understand that? It's right there. It's in the Bible. It's as plain as it can be. David also brings it up in the Psalms. We just didn't look at it today. The Jews know this. The Hebrews know this. Israel knows this. They know the division of the Abrahamic covenant. 21st century Gentile Christians, no clue. So, I'm in chapter 3 of Galatians. We're going to start at verse 15. Brethren, I speak in terms of human covenants. Even though it's only a man's covenant, yet when it has been ratified, no one can set it aside or add conditions to it. You understand what he's getting at? He says, let me first talk about human relationships. If two people, if Adrian and I agree, make a covenant with each other, Tim can't change our covenant. He's not in it. He can't do anything to it. It's our covenant. He can't add anything to it. He can't take anything away from it. Everybody would agree with Paul's basic premise. So he says in verse 16, now the promises were spoken to Abraham and to his seed. Now he does not say, and to seeds, as referring to many, but rather to one, and to your seed, and that is Christ. That's the purpose of all the genealogies that show the leading of the heritage from Abraham all the way to Jesus. He's the one through whom all the promises are going to be fulfilled. What I'm saying is this, verse 17, this is helpful. Okay, Paul. Paul says, now what I'm saying is this. And really, this is all I'm saying this morning. Do I have time to say it? Nope, no time. We're done. No, I'm joking. Okay. What I'm saying is this. The law, which came 430 years later, does not invalidate a covenant that was previously ratified by God so as to nullify the promise. For if the inheritance is based in the law, it's no longer based on promise, but God gave it to Abraham by means of a promise. In other words, the Abrahamic covenant is still good. Completely good. Still valid. And he wrote that after the cross. In other words, the law came, the law was taken out of the way. It did no damage to the Abrahamic covenant. The Abrahamic covenant is still good. It still stands. Next week, and when we pick up, the writer of Hebrews, who just introduced Abraham, is going to say, Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, all were given the promise, which I just showed you. And then he's going to say, and they all died having not received it. Isn't this interesting? Mm-hmm. It's fun to study the Bible. All right, this time I'm actually done. Are there any questions about that, I shudder to ask? You enjoying this?
Yes.
Yes.
Good. Be back next week. We'll pick up right there and we'll keep going. Say goodbye to the internet, folks.
Bye.
See you next time.
We thank you for joining us for this Salvation by Grace message. For more information, please visit our website at salvationbygrace.org. And join us next time as we gather around the Word and study the sovereign grace of God.